I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo, Sam Monson back with you here in late June. Still talking all things NFL. How you doing, Sam?
Good. How about you, Steve?
I'm doing great. You're back in your basement, I see.
I am. The sound should be better today. I'm still using the same equipment, but my basement is less of an echo chamber than the old man's office is.
Yes. I could already tell. It's much better. And again, we apologize.
Although, you were the person that told me it was fine the first time, so I'm not sure I should trust your audio ear there.
Just making you feel good. Not going to lie.
Okay. You had an interesting weekend, apparently.
I did. I was I almost kept my mustache for the podcast. So, yeah, I was at the NHRA drag racing all weekend.
Wow.
From all day Friday through Sunday afternoon, nonstop.
You don't strike me as the drag racing kind.
I'm not. I was trying to help out. That program that I work with, Heritage House over here in Cincinnati, they were ushers for the event to help raise money for the program. So I was involved with about 40 people. So I was living in a camper this weekend over at the drag racing. I grew a mustache so I fit in with the crowd and everything. And
how big a camper?
Oh, not big. I mean, maybe sleeps three, but it was just me and a friend. So it was just two of us. It was all right.
That feels like the kind of thing that should come with, photographic evidence of you in a small camper.
I know. Yeah. We probably didn't document my ridiculousness this weekend.
Yeah. I mean, look, I was telling my dad that you're this fascinating case study of this whole world that the rest of us don't even need to think about, right? Like weight limits on chairs and kayaks and since realizing that it's a thing, I've now discovered this whole world of things that Steve can't mess with because the weight limit is just too low, right?
And
that weight limit is 80 pounds before I even need to think about it. But for you, it's no, can't mess with that. I'm out. Go kayaking.
I can't do that. I was going to send you a picture. I forgot my camping chair, which has a 275-pound weight limit, and I had to borrow others where it was 250. So I was like, man, if I sit in this all weekend, we're going to be in trouble. But, I managed. We had fun. It was fun. A lot of it's loud, and it's big. It's bigger than I was never into drag racing. I didn't know how big it was, but there's a lot of people there.
That's just another thing that you can't do, You can't fit you in a dragster.
No, you see how tight they get in there and all. I mean, it's very precise. That's what my friend that was there called it, redneck calculus or something like that. Because he was this is so technical and all that stuff. And it was impressive watching.
I actually don't know if this holds for drag racing, but generally speaking, motor racing people are really small. Because the driver is unnecessary ballast, right? They're just unnecessary weight that you have to haul around the circuit.
Yeah.
So the smaller the driver, the better, right? Because a guy that, a guy that's Austin size is dragging around an awful lot less just extra weight than a guy that's your size, right?
Yeah.
It's an advantage. So I experienced a little bit of life with Steve this weekend, right? We were visiting my parents and I drove one of my dad's other ridiculous cars, which is a 1952 or one Jaguar XK120, tiny little sort of roadster thing from the 50s. And so the 50s, very small cars like the E-Type, but for some reason, very big steering wheels, right? Tiny car, giant steering wheel. And you sit in this thing, and if you want to use the throttle, the accelerator, the wheel is literally jammed up against your leg. You can't actually catches on your leg. I'm this is absurd. I can't fit in this car and operate it and I'm not a large human being.
That's me in a midsize.
Right.
Yeah.
I was like, Steve literally would not fit in this car. Like, it's one of those ones where I started trying to get into it, and my dad is like, no, you got to turn your leg the other way. You can't get into it that way. Like, if you did, you know, your knee won't bend the correct way to get it past the steering wheel, trying to get it in the way you're trying to get it in. Forget it.
Don't think it's easy being me. You think it's easy. Well, we both had, I mean, this is great summer weekends. You know, you just never know. Never know what you're going to get. Today, so let's get into some NFL stuff at some point. We're going to talk breakout players. We did that last year. Players that we're anticipating a big jump, whether it's early in their career, whatever it might be. We've got articles recently written about QBs and how they handle pressure. And we got potential fixes for a contending team, Sam. I also saw an email where, I don't know if I like this, but we have a podcast listener who wants to pit us against our listeners. I don't know if that's a smart
idea.
I like
this a lot. Yeah. So, email came in, and as always, send us emails, because good ideas like this pop along every now and again. Good ideas like the quarterbacks as sandwich thing come along, and just generally, it's a good place to be. So, NFLpodcast@pff.com is the email to fire stuff into. This email came in from Ken Horner. He sent us a couple of things. I don't even remember what the first one was, frankly, and it's not relevant to this. But the second idea, I think, is good. So he says, I heard the upset Raiders email. Remember, that was the email that was documenting point by point why Renner is an idiot and the rest of PFF, other than you, for some reason, hates the Raiders.
Yeah, smart email. Good email. Yep.
Yeah. So he said, he heard the upset Raiders email. Certain that your predictions of their chances of 2022 success weren't high enough. Maybe you could start adding a few of those types of objections to a list that you can then revisit next year and evaluate PFF's record versus the angry vocal listeners' record. I really like that. I think we should absolutely have a running tally of what we think versus what the listeners think for this upcoming season. And then, you know, we can give some kind of prize, award, you know, whatever. We can figure out something to do for people where they get it right and we get it wrong. Right?
Meet the podcast
we,
type
we
of
essentially
thing.
Bet with our listeners, right?
Yeah.
This is what PFF thinks. This is what our listeners think. And when they get it right and we get it wrong, you know, we'll throw them a bone somewhere.
And our currency is basically PFF subscriptions, right? I mean, we can
well,
hand those
that's
out.
That's definitely the cheapest way of doing it for us, yeah.
Well, I mean, we want to hand out stuff that we don't have to give up. So we can hand out PFF subscriptions. We can hand out all those free books that you're getting sent.
That's just what I'm thinking, yeah.
That's
it.
I could get you passes to NHRA, maybe, if you want to go watch some drag racing. I can get you in there. Know the owner up here in Norwalk, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
You know? We could give away free stuff.
You live close enough to Florida, maybe the old man can, you know, throw you a ride in the E-Type.
The E-Type. Oh, man. Free rides in the E-Type. That's definitely great. But you got to be under 6 feet like Sam here.
Oh, yeah, you got to be. Well, the E-Type, you got a bit more space in the E-Type. It's the 120 that's a problem for space.
Yeah, understood. So, yeah, I kind of like that as a thing. So I think in general we need to do a better job of keeping track. Can we get some interns keeping track of everything over here, please?
And the great thing is, right, unless they're very specific in their emails or complaints generally, we can kind of, you know, we can tilt the table in our favor, right?
Yeah.
So the Raiders won. You know,
that
thinks
happen.
The Raiders are great. We think the Raiders suck. We just have to set the line enough so that it's going to break our way. You know what I'm saying?
So like the Raiders have like over under's got to be like 11 wins here for this guy to be justified.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. So we can kind of rig it a little bit, you know?
Yeah. So, yes.
But we should absolutely set that up. A running tally of PFF versus the listeners. This should be the first one. Raiders hate, you know, PFF versus whatever this guy thinks they're going to finish at. And we'll revisit it after the season and see, you know, if we're worth listening to. Or if, in fact, we should just create our show based off what everybody else thinks. Because apparently we're idiots.
If we can't get some interns over here keeping track of this stuff, we might need some scribes straight from our listeners and viewers to keep track of this. Might need to. Might need a meme guy or something like that. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But I like this. So if you want to present an argument, say, for your team, for players, I think the best arguments, if you feel strongly, much like the Raiders email, would be, hey, you guys have hated on, or you haven't, you know, properly given credit to X player,
right,
team, whatever it is. you can state your case. Like, hey, you guys are hating on the Lions. Well, my Lions are going to go 12-5, right? Let's wager edge on it or whatever it might be.
And it can be, look, it can be teams, it can be players, you know, whatever it is. Basically, yeah. But you need to, yeah, it needs to be off the back of something we've already claimed or said, or, you know, we believe strongly and you happen to think is we're full of it. So anything that we have already put out there in terms of takes, there'll be a lot more as we approach the season and we preview, you know, what we think is going to happen for teams, for players, et cetera, et cetera. Email us in and tell us why we're wrong, right? NFLpodcast@pff.com, and let's set up a little wager between us and the listeners.
Reminder that the best place to play fantasy football this summer is Underdog Fantasy. Their Best Ball Mania tournament has $10 million in total prize money. And the best part is you just draft your fantasy football team, and that's it. There's no waivers, no trades, no in-season management. Underdog gives you your best score each week of the season, and the highest scores at the end of the year win. The champion of Best Ball Mania last year drafted right here in June, so there's no time like the present to join Underdog and take your shot at a multi-million dollar draft. Plus, Underdog is going to double your first deposit up to $100 when you sign up with the promo code PFF. Also, if you play 10 of those dollars using promo code PFF, you get a free PFF subscription. So what are you waiting for? Head to UnderdogFantasy.com or the App Store, play $10 with code PFF, and draft your Best Ball Mania team today. Your kind of fantasy team here, Sam. Set it
helping out good
and
people.
Forget it.
The friend of the show, Josh Norris.
Yeah, we like those guys over at Underdog. So appreciate their support. We appreciate the ability to support them. And we think we've got a great deal for everybody. Go to Underdog Fantasy right now and check it out. All right, man. What do you want to start with here?
You want to tell me, Steve. You're the guy in charge.
Yeah, sometimes I defer responsibilities to you in the summer. You know what I mean? I try to, like, take the summer off.
Oh, the summer. I see.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I'm in summer mode.
Okay.
You know, I was talking to Renner. This is the summer of Mike over here. He's, like, in between podcasts, you know?
Yeah.
Just kind of lurking out there. And Mike doesn't have a home, you know?
Right.
It's kind of Mike's dream job, right? You're getting paid, and you don't really have stuff to do, you know?
That does sound very Mike, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, somebody should make him do something. You know, he kind of writes a couple articles a week, but he's just, you know, puppy without a home right now in podcast land. I don't know what the plan is. Somebody get Renner a job.
You're taking off, right? You're not here for a couple of shows, so maybe we can get Renner in for those.
That's what I did. You know, I'm like, Mike, since you're not working, you know.
You started off with these grand plans of, you know, I'll get all these people in. It'll be, you know, star-studded guest lineup. And it was just, we'll just get Renner in for the last few.
It was Rick Spielman. Greg Rosenthal.
Yeah, started off well.
Yeah. There's nobody else that was good. There's no one else.
That was it.
There's no one else our listeners want to hear. And poor Renner, you got to keep his skills sharp, you know?
Mm.
It's not easy to just roll in and talk. You know, you got to stay sharp.
Okay.
But you can get him on here. Let's go breakout players for the 2022 season. I want to give a little reminder of what this may have looked like last year at this point. So this is one of those things where we do need somebody to, like, help us keep track, because we did a breakout players episode last year. I don't remember who we said.
No,
I'm pretty sure I said Quinnen Williams was one of the guys that would become a star. Mm. I don't think that happened.
No.
But the actual breakout players last year, we saw Max Crosby go from pretty good, like a decent every down edge defender, to one of the best in the league, right? Unstoppable pass rusher, even against a weak slate of right tackles. He dominated those guys, several 10-plus pressure games. What, it was 100 total for the season that he ended up with? Max Crosby, Devondre Campbell, two Packers, really. Devondre Campbell and Rashawn Gary. Gary doing it in year three as a former first-round pick. Devondre Campbell doing it pretty much in the middle of his career and not having a year that didn't look anything like his previous career. Jordan Mailata broke out last year, a guy, you know, former rugby star turned left tackle, and he had been getting better and better, but he became one of the best left tackles in the league last year. You saw AJ Terrell, a cornerback, former Clemson first rounder, become really good. So I mean, just an example of last year at this time, guys who were either coming off of, you know, just middling early career performance, and then all of a sudden becoming stars. So do you have some players you want to highlight here as far as breakout players? I've got at least a few that we can discuss.
So the first one I think is worth talking about is a player who changed his name, Deonte Hardy, formerly what the hell was his name? Deonte Harris.
Harris. Yeah.
Forgot what he called himself. So Hardy's this, you know, tiny kind of speedster gimmick player for the New Orleans Saints. 5'6", like 170 pounds. And has only really been kind of deployed in those either designated deep threats or kind of gimmick roles in the offense. But when you look at his profile, so one, the grades are pretty insane, and they've gotten better as he's played in the NFL, as his role has gotten bigger each season of his career. When you look at the kind of profile and start diving deeper and you look at, you know, whether it's against man coverage or zone coverage, press, all these kinds of things, he actually grades well in like every subset that is typically indicative of, you know, can you win in a larger role? Can you be a much bigger player in your offense? And when you watch the Saints, like, he was the biggest threat they had. Okay, a lot of that was by default, right? That was not a good receiving core, and there were a lot of it was just sort of waiting for somebody to make some plays, right? And with no Michael Thomas and blah, blah, blah. This is now tougher with Chris Olave in the room, with Michael Thomas presumably coming back. Carving a role that's larger than the one he had last year is going to be trickier to do. But every sort of shred of evidence out there suggests that with any kind of competent quarterback play, and look, Jameis Winston may be a loose cannon, maybe, you know, wildly inconsistent, but he's competent. With competent quarterback play, I think there is actually a pretty decent season to be had for Deonte Hardy.
Man, I like that. I wasn't expecting a Deonte Hardy one, but I mean, there's a point. There's a lot of NFL teams. Who are the guys? They had. I mean, the what I would have like John Ross do essentially, just be kind of like the designated deep threat. You know, your fourth wide receiver. And Harris actually did that as well as anybody over these last couple of years. Who was the guy? Khalif Raymond did it for the Titans, right? Who was the guy in the Lions a couple of years ago, too? I'm sorry. Why is my mind going blank? But there were these guys who would have, for the season, it'd be like 10 catches, 240 yards, right? Like, it's all just deep threat type of stuff. Deonte Hardy now did that extremely well in that particular role. And then what that does, so if you're just running deep posts and overs and goes and all that stuff, all of a sudden that opens up a deep comeback, a deep out route, and a guy can become a little bit more than a, you know, 20 yards per catch guy. I think he's got those types of skills. He's such a dynamic punt returner. So, you know, how much do you want to take him away from that? But I like that call, you know, especially on a Saints receiving core where, yeah, they've added, you know, with Chris Olave and Michael Thomas coming back, but they have those guys that could be more high-volume guys. Hardy could still play to his strengths and become a legitimate deep threat and maybe even a little bit more coming off that.
Yeah, I really think, I mean, as I say, it's a tougher room to do it in this year because you're going to have some competition for targets with some legit wide receivers there. But Hardy has a skill set that he could be a real impact playmaker for them.
All right, so I'm gonna pull my breakout players in part based off of what we saw – what we thought about them coming out of college. Have they reached their potential yet? So I'm going to start with Christian Barmore from the New England Patriots, a guy that we had as our number one interior defensive lineman in the 2021 draft. He fell all the way to pick 38, goes in the second round to the Patriots last year. We did see him play. It's not like he wasn't on the field. Over 600 snaps, 63 PFF grade. By the way, you can get all these grades, stats, snap counts, all that stuff over at PFF.com using promo code NFLPOD, you can get 25% off. This is straight from our Elite Package, Premium Stats. So you have Edge or Elite, you can get 25% off any of those subscriptions using NFLPOD. But Barmore had a 76 pass rush grade. He still had 51 pressures. He wasn't nearly as good against the run. So a guy that hasn't put it all together yet, but in one facet was really good. But I think he's the type of guy, he was explosive. He's difficult to block. I think, you know, adjusting to the Patriots system as a run defender, probably a little bit more difficult for Barmore, but I think he's got the ability to be a legitimate breakout player. So for the second year in a row, I'll go with another former Alabama interior defensive lineman as a breakout player. I'm going to say Christian Barmore is going to take a big step forward this year.
Yeah, I like that. I think there's every chance that he will. Remember, like, Barmore, the consensus kind of number one interior player in that draft class, but one that didn't go very high, and a lot of people couldn't work out why, you know, and a lot of the times when that happens, it's because it's not an on the field tape problem. It's a, you know, doesn't interview well. It's a character concerns. It's a whatever it is. It's something that doesn't show up in their tape. You know, you're not looking at this now. Ah, there's the problem, right? I've identified it. That's why he's not going high. It's something that you don't know that's happening behind the scenes. So the Patriots draft him, and all of a sudden you're like, well, okay, whatever it is, it automatically makes you a little bit less concerned just because of the history of the Patriots, the environment they are working with, the general sort of ambience of being able to take these quote unquote problem child players and, you know, turn them into something good. So immediately you're a little bit less concerned. And then so far what we've seen from him, like, it's already apparent he can play, right?
Yeah.
So even if it was, whether it's character concerns, whether it's like, you know, questions about whether he'll pick up the playbook, like whatever the issue is, right now, it shouldn't be a big issue because we've already seen him play pretty well for a year within that environment. The environment isn't really changing. You know, I know they're tooling around with coaches in the Patriots organization generally, but overall, this is the same thing. I think it's set for him to take a big step year two.
All right, man. Who else? Any other players? I mean, I hope you have some other players, but
yeah.
Who else you got?
Joseph Noteboom. Offensive tackle for the Rams. Now, they paid him like they're expecting this breakout as well.
You're following the money trail here behind the Rams' evaluation of Noteboom.
Well, certainly in this instance. I mean, the money trail matches up with the small sample size of very good play, right? The Rams, you know, they had Andrew Whitworth playing out of his mind at the age of 40, you know, old man Whit out there. Whitworth misses a little bit of time. Joseph Noteboom comes in, plays left tackle, which is essentially the first real time, not the first time that he'd done that, but first time he'd had one position to play for the season. Came in, played left tackle, had a couple of starts there, and looked really good in those starts. He also had one starter or one game at right tackle as well. But, you know, anyway, Noteboom, college left tackle, grades well in those couple of games at left tackle. And then the Rams, you know, Whitworth retires, and the Rams don't just sort of, you know, make him a modest offer to keep him around. They pay him pretty big money to keep him in the building as Whitworth's successor. So you put all those things together. He's athletic. He's got the prototype. He's got the size. Like, everything you want is there. And the Rams, at least, clearly believe that that's going to happen. So, you know, I will give them the benefit of the doubt and join my way to their predictions and suggest that Noteboom will have a good season as well.
Yeah, I like it. I think, you know, one of the ways, it doesn't always work, but grabbing small sample size of good play,
right,
and projecting it forward. We have seen that historically. We saw that with Richard Sherman early in his career, and Chris Harris, and Shaq Barrett was a guy. You know, you do see that sometimes where a guy just does well either filling in as a starter or as a role player, and then when given the bigger opportunity, they do perform well. So, yeah, I'm interested to see Noteboom's development because there were other paths, I think, that the Rams could have taken at left tackle, right? And they invested in him, you know, probably even before they needed to, even. I like it. One of the players I want to highlight, too, I'll do two Browns at the same time here. Chase Winovich. All right, so I'm going to take a stab at this one. Chase Winovich breaking out with the Browns. New, you know, he was a guy that we really liked coming out, goes third round out of Michigan to the Patriots, right? Third or fourth round. But Winovich, early on, it was like, wow, this guy looks great. Steal for the Patriots, right? He's a good pass rusher. He was pretty solid against the run. But there was a point where things got a little ugly in New England, right? He just wasn't fitting in. And with the Patriots, because they are so scheme-specific every single week, sometimes you have a guy that maybe is a good pass rusher, but they want him to drop into coverage. They want him to just, you know, play the run, whatever it might be. Winovich didn't take to all of the many roles that the Patriots put him in, but I still think he can get after the quarterback. And I think the Browns are going to give him that opportunity. You've got Myles Garrett there. You got Clowney officially back yet with them.
Yeah.
And Winovich can be that number three edge and maybe just get after the quarterback and be, say, a 50 pressure guy in a third edge defender type of role. I think he has that type of potential. So I'm going to go back to some previous evaluation and what we've seen in the NFL and say change of scenery is going to work for Chase Winovich. And then Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah, Again, did he break out last year as a rookie? Yes. Let's say he becomes a star this year at linebacker. So he's my good to great type of prediction. I think JOK, the speed, the recognition, the way he plays the game, taking that to the next level this season for the Browns.
The Winovich one is interesting because he's been, you know, okay, but he's never kicked on the way we thought he could, the way, you know, potentially he showed like he might earlier in his career. And he's one of those, you know, we talk all the time about how you really like to see that sort of the nice, neat pattern of a grade right. getting better every year and a guy just ascending, nice, neat, linear curve of just getting better every year of his career. Winovich's pass rushing grade has gotten worse each year of his career, right? Started off and it was the pass rushing grade got slightly better year one to year two and then drove off a cliff when he barely played, but it hasn't had that nice linear jump every year that we expected. It kind of hit this plateau and hasn't taken off. And at the same time, remember that was the Michigan team where Winovich was one player, Rashawn Gary was the other, and it was the sort of almost like a referendum on do you prefer incredible production or incredible athleticism, right? Rashawn Gary was the sort of freak prototype athlete, but hadn't really produced that much in college. And Winovich was the guy that produced a ton, but didn't have the physical tools Gary did. And, you know, draft time, PFF was all about, we'll take the guy that's proven it over the super athlete. And year one, it looked good, right? Year one, Winovich was the productive guy. Rashawn Gary didn't really show it. And now a few years down the line, Rashawn Gary just had his breakout season. He looks like one of the best edge rushers in the NFL right now. And Winovich has gone in the other direction, just hasn't been that guy. So I'm interested to see that one. I'm kind of out of confidence at this point with Winovich, but I'm here to see it. I'm going to stick with the linebacker thing, though, because I think JOK is a good one. I think he would have already broken out if he'd stayed healthy the whole year and just been a superstar already. I think that Zaven Collins could be prime for a big year for Arizona. The Cardinals have had this run now where they've been taking these linebackers in the first round, Isaiah Simmons, Zaven Collins, and then they just don't play them as rookies, right? And with Isaiah Simmons, I think the plan was to play him, and then Kyle Shanahan just like took a blowtorch to the guy in week one or week two or whatever it was, and they just reassessed the entire plan. It's like, oh, dude, if he's out here and this is how teams are treating it, just like putting a bullseye on him, that's not going to work. So they like massively scale back his playing time. They had him just in a sub package and then eventually scaled it back up as the year went on. Zaven Collins, though, just couldn't even get on the field. Like they didn't have him playing. They had Hicks, they had Isaiah Simmons. There was just no playing time for Collins. And yet every time he actually got on the field, he looked good. And even in like tiny sample size stuff, you know, you sort of saw the tiny margins for error that linebackers have at this level. Like he was on the field for a little bit against Carolina and he just got put in a blender. Like there was one play where he got one-on-one in the open field against, you know, it was Christian McCaffrey who just wrecked him. And then there was a play where he was like one-on-one against Cam Newton, you know, down by the goal line again. It's like, it's tough. Like playing linebacker's a nightmare in today's NFL. That's why some of these guys struggle when they transition. But I think you could see him read the run game in particular really well. He filled against the run really quickly, really decisively, made an impact there. I didn't see a problem in coverage or sort of range, all those kinds of things. I think he just needed playing time, and there wasn't any last season for him in Arizona. But they've moved on, you know, from one linebacker. Simmons is still there. I think this is Collins' job this season, and based off last year, I don't see any reason why he couldn't have a big jump this season.
I'll tell you what could be huge for Arizona is if that does come true and Isaiah Simmons breaks out in year three, because Isaiah Simmons hasn't lived up to his hype as the number 8 overall linebacker. Like, to your point, Collins has generally played decent in his limited time. So, yeah, if they can get those back-to-back first-round linebackers looking a little bit better, maybe make up for the question marks that they have at cornerback there, right? The fact that Arizona can maybe manufacture a pass rush if J.J. Watt gets back. You've got guys like Byron Murphy, Buda Baker on the back end. Like, you need these linebackers to step up. So I think not only is Zaven Collins a potential breakout player, but an important one, you know, in that system for Arizona. I'm going to go back to last year's rookies. and say Elijah Moore. So Jets wide receiver. Again, another guy that started to figure out a little bit better. I think down the stretch, I was a little – I think there's some nuanced stuff to his route running he can get a little bit better at, but the guy knows how to get open. He's very good. I think the additions of Garrett Wilson, already having Corey Davis there, you know, again, more weapons, more ability there, but I think he could steal some Corey Davis targets, right? And as Garrett Wilson's getting up to speed, we don't see receivers immediately hit the ground running all the time. So Elijah Moore being a year ahead, say, of a Garrett Wilson, could steal some targets early on. And Moore's good. He's just good overall. And I think he's got a chance to be a breakout star this year, maybe coinciding with Zach Wilson potentially breaking out for the Jets. We'll see.
How do you see the breakdown of targets going with the Jets? Because like you said, Garrett Wilson, their top or their first-round pick this year, a first-round pick. Corey Davis, the great Hall of Famer, you know, gets to move back to being a number two. You have Braxton Berrios still there to kind of muddy the slot targets as well. But Elijah Moore is a player that isn't just a slot guy, you know, is not purely pegged as being a slot receiver only. I think, you know, me and Mike Renner had that debate before the draft. I think he's already shown at the very minimum that they're prepared to use him outside. And that will be a part of his game rather than being limited to strictly a slot player only. So how do you see that breakdown of him? Like, where do the targets come from in terms of him having a monster season?
We might not see it in volume, but I think we'll see. I think we can see it in grade and efficiency with Moore. Because to your point, not only do they have all those receivers, but you also have Tyler Conklin, who came in at tight end, and CJ Uzomah. Like, both guys that they paid a decent chunk of change at tight end. But I think they've built a system with the Jets that is more conducive to winning, because in any given week, maybe the tight ends are there. You know, maybe it's the receivers. Maybe it's the run game. It is a Shanahan's system. But I think Elijah Moore steals some of Corey Davis's targets this year if he plays better, right? I mean, if he's just more, he's just used to the system. You steal some of Corey Davis's. Garrett Wilson has time to get acclimated. I think Moore could be the number two targeted receiver this year. Behind, say, Corey Davis, right? It's kind of a lot. It depends on Garrett Wilson's development, who, you know, he's really good, but I don't know if he's going to have a Jamar Chase impact right away and just become the number one. So I think Elijah Moore could be target number two for the Jets, but I'm calling this breakout less so that, like, hey, we're going to see 90 catches from him, and more so we're just going to be like, hey, this guy's a really good, efficient, move the chains type of receiver. Guy gets open, guy always gets the job done, and he'll have some games. There'll be some games where Elijah Moore's the dude, right, for the Jets. Other times it could be the tight ends, could be Corey Davis, could be Garrett Wilson, but I think that's the beauty of putting that group of pass catchers together for the Jets. They've done a really nice job of giving themselves some options.
Okay. I think that we should remember.
More.
Say that again?
I have one more.
Okay.
Whenever you're ready.
I think we need to remember that Travis Etienne is a thing.
Ooh,
you know?
Yeah.
First-round pick. First round pick that they then tried to turn into some kind of like hybrid slash actual receiver. But Etienne has this profile of, you know, that speed and explosiveness thing where, you know, once you can get through that line, you can take the ball 50 yards, right? That, I think the trend of running backs in today's NFL is less about short area, you know, contact balance and ability to make people miss and yards after contact. It's about, like, can you find a crease, burst through the line, and then accelerate past everybody, you know, and outrun people into space? Because that's kind of what today's offenses are doing. All this wide zone stuff, all these spread formations, you're creating more space in and around the line of scrimmage. So you don't need a guy that can make four people miss and kind of drag bodies for eight more yards. You need a guy who, if you can give him a yard of space with the blocking, he can just outrun the players at the second level and the third level into much more space and create massive plays. And, you know, the analytics and the data is sort of showing this tight correlation between that type of player, the explosive skill set and production, obviously. And Etienne, certainly of that draft class, like, was the best running back that fit that profile. He had that explosive knack, the ability to turn those plays into huge gains at any given moment. And then the guy was on the shelf, you know, for the entirety of his rookie year, didn't feature, didn't play at receiver or running back, I think that cross training at receiver can't have hurt. You know, that only, I think, helped his case. Even if he goes back to being a running back right now, I think that didn't do him any harm whatsoever. And now, you know, we're expecting this offense to be functional without Urban Meyer and the disaster, the toxic environment that was there year one. And, you know, there's a group of people expecting Trevor Lawrence to take that step as well. So I think Travis Etienne is a guy that a lot of people are sort of forgetting about because he just hasn't featured yet. But this is a guy that profiled as potentially being the best running back from his draft class. And whether he's a running back or a hybrid weapon or a receiver, the dude has playmaking ability.
I always thought there was some Dalvin Cook-esque elements
to his game, right?
Dalvin tested what he ran in the 4.4s, but it's like when you watch him on the field, he runs 4.3, right? I mean, he's a 4.3 on the field, angle-breaking runner. Etienne definitely had elements of that at Clemson. He just knew how to create big plays. So, yeah, that's a good one because we didn't see him last year. And if the Jags do take a step forward, I think he'll have more opportunities there. I was not the guy I was thinking of, but I was going to say Javonte Williams too, the other 2021 running back. It's drafted a few picks behind Etienne and already got off to a pretty decent start, forced a ridiculous 63 missed tackles on just 203 carries. That's an insane number. But now with Russell Wilson in Denver, Javonte Williams probably stealing more carries, right? In the, you know, he was sharing time last year with Melvin Gordon. I think Javonte Williams has a chance to really be a breakout player as well. I'm sure the fantasy people are already all over that, so that's not a unique take. This will be a unique take. Breakout player for this year. Trayvon Diggs. Trayvon Diggs is going to break out in PFF terms. Right? The world says he's already become the best corner in the NFL. He's got 11 interceptions last year and all that stuff. I think Trayvon Diggs is going to have one of those years where he has far fewer interceptions, five or six, whatever it might be, and be a better player, right? I think he's been a good corner. He's been a good, solid corner to this point. He'll cut down on some of the – I mean, there were coverage busts last year. They were just – he gave up over 1,000 yards, which is – again, we track all of this stuff. It's not always fair to directly give every coverage yard to the player. It's just this general gauge. I think the PFF grade does a really good job, though, of saying where a guy played or how well a guy played. And Diggs has been a solid corner for 2 years, and I think he's got a chance to take a step back and actually be more of a lockdown, don't give up catches, don't give up big plays corner, while at the same time not having nearly as many interceptions, right? The balls are not going to find his hands as much this year, the tipped passes and all those plays. So I think Trayvon Diggs is going to be better this year than he was last year, snap to snap.
I would love to see you write the article after the season that says that, you know, Trayvon Diggs had a breakout year and just watch your replies when they come in for that. By the way, you're right. The idea that, you know, assigning yards individually to one player is not always the cleanest way of doing it. And, you know, there are yards in there that potentially belong equally to somebody else in addition to Trayvon Diggs' bad coverage on the play. You know, and if you take those away from him, it's not 1,000 yards, maybe 800 yards. That's true, but you can almost entirely offset the yards that you would be removing with the ones that you add back on if you counted as penalties. You know what I mean?
No,
like penalties or yards that we kind of forget about and dismiss because they don't appear in coverage numbers. They appear, they don't even, like, you have to go looking for them and tot up. Like, okay, if all these penalties are attributed in yardage terms, what does that do? Well, you know, Diggs had an absolute ton of penalties. So if we take away those yards that might not technically entirely belong to him in coverage, we can add them back with the penalty plays. So, you know, you can't, we don't, there's a reason that Trayvon Diggs had the coverage grade that he had, right? And it's not explained by, well, the system's flawed. It's giving him yardage that he doesn't, you know, deserve. I mean, there's more yardage out there as well.
How many penalties last year? 11.
Yeah.
11 penalties last year for Trayvon Diggs. Yeah. Look, I just think he'll be better this year. If I do write the article that he broke out this year, that would, I mean, that feels like trolling. That feels like idiots, you know. But we'll see. You know, Diggs ends up with like an 84 coverage grade, you know, adds almost 20 points to his coverage grade and has like three picks. That'd be great. But that's what we've said throughout the years, right? Is don't look at just a handful of plays. Don't look at just the box score. And the box score doesn't, of all sports, the box score probably tells the worst story in football as far as just traditional box score stats go, in my opinion. So, by the way, let us know in the chat. We've already got some people, you know, predicting their breakout players. Let us know in the chat. Who do you think is going to break out this year? We have a Panthers fan here who's I respect when you read the, you know, the beat writer hype. You know, you got to read the hype in June. You got to read the mini camp hype. He's talking about.
Please don't tell me Sam Darnold is going to break out.
No. Jared Patterson in the chat here. I think he's smarter than that. He's talking about Terrace Marshall. He's talking about J.C. Horn as potential breakout guys. I could see all that. I could see that. We've got somebody recommending Jerry Jeudy. Our own Mike Renner did write an article a few weeks back about third-year breakout players. He predicted Jerry Jeudy as the top player right there, I think. Are you on board with that as a Jerry Jeudy guy? Are you expecting a year three breakout there?
I am being extremely quiet about Jerry Jeudy because I don't want to jinx it.
Yeah.
You know, I desperately hope and would love to see Jerry Jeudy break out with Russell Wilson, but I don't want to ruin it because, you know, have you seen the PFF Twitter account is out here throwing around the player's name willy nilly. Like there's no injury jinx attached to this. And, you know, people are tagging us about, have you seen what's happening? I've seen it. There's nothing I can do about it. I've made our stance clear, and they're throwing his name out there. And look,
I'm not sure. Where's Gordon? Gordon, you got to get the social team listening to the PFF NFL podcast here. You got to understand the rules. Number three on the Chargers. We don't mention his name.
No.
Hashtag the player.
When you do, he gets injured.
Yeah. I mean, he's probably under the knife right now after that tweet. Just saying. But we appreciate the listeners responding properly to the tweet and putting our social team in their place. Don't mention the dude's name.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have anyone else?
No, I think we're done with breakout players.
All right. So, appreciate all the insight, too, in the YouTube chat. Who else do we have? Anyone else? Jalen Phillips going to have a monster season, establish himself as one of the elite pass rushers. Dolphins edge defender, first round pick. Alan Lazard, somebody that people have brought up in part because of opportunities. Could happen.
The Lazard, I think, has a good chance to start the season as Aaron Rodgers' unquestioned number one target. I just don't know that you can look at Lazard's career so far and see that he has the skill set to continue that for any length of time. Like, if Rodgers was able to create a monster season out of Alan Lazard, it would be one of the most impressive quarterback feats we've seen in a long, long time. Like that, Lazard has a lot to like about him, and Rodgers clearly trusts him, which is no small thing, by the way. Like, one of the issues with Aaron Rodgers and potentially why Green Bay's receiving core has been, you know, a little bit of a problem, even with an elite wide receiver, has been like the guy is not able to very quickly and immediately build like this chemistry connection rapport with anybody. Like, he just doesn't trust some of these guys. And a lot of what he does is built on that trust. You watch the number of times, like if he looks up and it's single coverage in Davante Adams, it's just like an auto target. You know, the ball's going there and oftentimes it's back shoulder, and that kind of just knowledge between the two of them is built in, and it's a level of trust. Lazard is the first guy who's come in and you can see that Rodgers trusts him in a similar way. Now, obviously Lazard doesn't have Davante Adams' skill set, so it doesn't end in the same results, but Lazard has a similar thing where, like, if Rodgers looks up, sees him in single coverage in the outside with nobody else there, he'll throw it there without thinking about it. And he doesn't do that to an awful lot of receivers. So there's something to that. And that is a huge advantage that Lazard has over Christian Watson and Romeo Doubs and Sammy Watkins. He's already got that in the bank. So I think he starts off as the team's number one target and the guy that gets, you know, a lot of opportunity because of that. But he just doesn't have the dynamism. He just doesn't have, like, the all-round skill set to be a dominant receiver. So there's only so long that Rodgers can keep pitching him the ball 15 times a game, you know, and hope that that's enough. Like, eventually he's going to have to pivot away and find somebody else. Or, you know, if he can, as I said, like, create like a 1,200-yard receiver and 10 touchdowns out of Alan Lazard based purely off the fact that he trusts him and he's Aaron Rodgers, so we can put the ball like into a window on his back shoulder, that will be a pretty incredible feat.
I think you're underrating Lazard a little bit. He's a, I mean, for his size, you think he's going to be a clunky route runner. I mean, he can get open a little bit. Again, he's not Devontae Adams. We're never going to say he is, but I like Lazard. He's a solid player. You're right, though. He's going to probably see a lot of targets early on, especially, I mean, if Christian Watson becomes like a second half breakout, you know, they slowly bring him along and then he becomes a legit threat by week 10 or whatever. That's not a bad path for the Packers either. You know, for Watson to eventually become, you'll earn his targets maybe as the season goes. All right, well, I want to get into quarterbacks under pressure and how much they drop off. But first, gentlemen, all men strive for gold in their life, right? Gold watches, gold medals, gold everything. However, there's a certain type of man who goes the extra mile. He walks with the confidence of an eagle and giggles in the face of danger. He's a big, hairless, winning machine. And when he unzips his pants, he sees platinum. Platinum? That's right. Manscaped would like to introduce you to their best and biggest ultimate hygiene bundle yet, the Platinum Package 4.0. Manscaped is the leader in below-the-waist grooming. Now trust them with the whole shebang. Join the 4 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped by going to manscaped.com. You get 20% off plus free shipping using the code PFF. Manscaped's brand new Platinum Package 4.0 is the biggest bundle they've ever offered, giving you a bulk discount on Manscaped's top products. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code PFF over at manscaped.com. It's 20% off plus free shipping at manscaped.com. Use code PFF. It's time you enjoyed the finer things in life and get yourself a platinum package for your platinum package. Say it with a straight face, Steve. Say it with a straight face. Platinum package 4.0. Go Manscaped. Manscaped.com. Use PFF.
And we got some healthy discount going on that platinum package there.
That's right. That's right. 20% platinum. Off, man.
Yes. Also, I'm a big fan of any read that uses the term shebang.
The whole shebang.
Don't hear that very often.
Yeah.
I think we should hear it more.
It also helps me from listing out all of the items, but they're all great, right? So
yeah,
you get a lot of different items. It's the whole shebang. Check it out, manscaped.com. All right, let's go. The quarterbacks who dropped off the most under pressure. You want to put a little background to this and where this is found over at PFF.com?
Yeah, well, it's found over at PFF.com.
I gave
Brian
you the answer.
Torn wrote the article. So quarterback under pressure is one of those fascinating elements of quarterback play. And one of the things that we've discovered, you know, at PFF is that the play when you're not under pressure, play from a clean pocket is way more predictable, way more stable, predictable year on year. That's the thing to sort of focus on in terms of how good a quarterback is and how good you can expect him to be going forward. Essentially, play under pressure. It's noisy. There's a lot of variance there. It can swing wildly year to year in one direction or other. And particularly guys that are very good under pressure is generally not very sustainable and predictable year to year. Now, where I think it does get a little bit interesting is that I think guys that struggle under pressure is a little bit more predictable than guys that thrive under pressure. And in particular, you know, guys that do very well from a clean pocket but do very badly when they're under pressure, I think there is something to those players. And that is a type of guy that doesn't necessarily change. Like the variance may change year to year, you know. So the biggest difference from any player last year was Jimmy Garoppolo, right? Number one, he had a clean pocket grade of 90.2, so elite, right? Elite from a clean pocket. But when he was pressured, his passing grade dropped 29.2, right? Which is about as bad as it gets. Basically goes from being an elite top five type of quarterback to being the worst passer in the NFL if you were able to apply pressure in the pocket.
Again, that's using PFF passing grade, not passer rating or anything like that. Correct. We're talking about passing grade, grading every single player, every single throw by the quarterback.
Right. So that,
look at those top two players, my comps, man.
You're right. Jimmy Garoppolo and Tua. So the point being, like, that's the severity of that swing will change year to year, right? It's not going to go from 90 to 30 every single season. But Jimmy Garoppolo, I think, is a player that will find that kind of breakdown, you know, a lot of seasons, more often than not, we're going to see like a pretty significant drop from him. He's not a guy that thrives under pressure. You go back to 2019, similar story, right? 90 grade when he was kept clean, 42 when he was pressured. Was 2018, which was his good season, 2017. That's the one.
2017 is when he got traded and had that run where the Niners went 6-0, graded at 86,
earned him his contract. Yeah. That's the one year where it was all kind of level, right? Where he didn't see this massive drop off when he was pressured. But otherwise, basically every single season of his career, we've seen a pretty significant drop off from him when he got pressured. So that to me is why the list is pretty interesting, because I think the type of player that falls into this category, it may not be every season and the severity may change, but this type of player, I think, is a thing that there are guys that will be in this bucket essentially for the majority of their career.
Yeah, and so Tua being number two, I've continued to make a Jimmy Garoppolo type of comp for Tua. And there's a lot of ways that that can show up, perhaps in the difference between clean pocket and pressured. Part of the reason why I made that comp coming out is because Tua did have some head scratchers under pressure, right? And that's where Garoppolo, all of our week-by-week analysis, particularly last year, Sam, was like, man, Jimmy G's not bad, but there are three or four plays per game where he just throws it to the defense. He does panic a little bit. Last year, he had 14 turnover-worthy plays, no big-time throws when under pressure, right? There was just guys bearing down on him, and he's just kind of throwing it up for grabs. Now, part of the reason why under-pressure play is inconsistent is because I've said the opposite about Garoppolo at various points in his career, especially early on. His willingness to make throws under pressure and kind of sidearm it around the defender who's like directly in his face, and he made some great throws. The willingness sometimes, it's a good thing, right? You stand in there, you make these plays, but the results are all over the place. This was always my contention with Nick Foles, right? He's going to stand in there. Sometimes it's going to go well. Sometimes it's not going to go well. For Garoppolo, particularly these last couple of years, it has not gone well. Because again, what looks like a little panicky when it doesn't, it looks a little panicky when it doesn't go well. It looks tough when it does go well. You know what I mean? But it's the same idea. The willingness to make plays under pressure. Garoppolo kind of has that. And again, with Tua, both of these guys, I don't think either guy has a spectacular arm. And you know, you have to be absolutely precise when you're making plays under pressure, and you can't lose any velocity, and you have to be able to throw off platform. And I think those might be a couple of those things that Jimmy G and Tua are perhaps lacking here, and why they have the biggest drop off under pressure.
I was going to make a point about Tua, and then it occurred to me that I don't know if it's actually true or not.
That's okay. You just make it anyway.
Well, I can find out if you know if it's true or not, if this is something we've tested or if this is something we should test. You know, in Tua's defense was my point that, like, Miami's offensive line was historically wretched. Like, it was the worst offensive line in the NFL. It was a disaster, even though it was being protected reasonably well schematically in terms of RPOs and getting the ball out quickly. It was a disaster. And I think pressure is one of those things where it compounds or it multiplies depending on how much pressure you get. Like, if you have a guy who's under pressure, you know, 15% of the time, it's less of a big deal than the guy who's under pressure 45% of the time, you know, three times more, it's going to have a bigger impact. And I think that's why, you know, you see quarterbacks that get broken by pressure, because even when the pressure isn't coming, they feel it. Like, they anticipate the pressure because they've been under so much of it. Have we tested that? Like, the more pressure you get, the bigger a problem it is, the bigger an impact it has?
I don't know. We could probably take a look at that. You and I looked at it at a game level a little bit, right? We looked at it, hey, if you get over 40% or so, it's just like, all right, this is, you just can't perform. Like, your bottom line statistically that game is going to take a massive hit.
I'd be interested to see, just as a general league-wide trend in, you know, in terms of EPA or whatever the output you want to look at, does the volume of pressure you create make the individual pressure have a bigger impact? And I would suggest it does, but I think we probably need, you know, the R&D guys, the good doctor, to take a look at it and get some proof.
The other element there is that the QB does control his pressure rate, right, a little bit. So there's this element of you're at the mercy of your offensive line a percentage of the time, and then you also can just make better decisions and not be under pressure. So the top two on the list, Jimmy Garoppolo, Tua, both guys had the biggest drop-offs from clean pocket performance to pressured pocket performance. Again, performance is best measured by PFF grade, not by team-based stats like EPA or passer rating and things like that. Number three was Davis Mills, so a couple of rookies here. Davis Mills, big drop-off. Justin Fields, a big drop-off. Fields is one of those guys. Again, the narrative is the offensive line was trash. He was always under pressure. There were some plays where that was absolutely true. There was also plenty of plays where Justin Fields did not get the ball out quickly. The same issue that he looked like he had at Ohio State did show up as a rookie. So Justin Fields wasn't good under pressure, and he also probably invited way more pressure than he should have as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
want to mention this too. Scheme matters in a lot of these cases. We've seen it anecdotally, like you see certain plays. Andrew Luck had times in his career where it's like the blitz is coming, and you look at the pass concept, it's like, where is he supposed to throw the ball? He's got like 3 15-yard routes going, yeah, and he's got no outlet. He's got nobody to throw it to.
I mean,
avoiding a negative for a quick dump off or a hot route or whatever it might be. Sometimes it's just not baked into the system the way it needs to. So system matters to a point when it comes to under pressure, particularly against the blitz, because you have to have answers, and not every system is properly equipped for that, we'll say.
Yeah, it's not even just scheme. Like, everything matters. And this is, if you zoom all the way out, right, this is the crux of why football has taken over the world in this landscape of social media and instant reaction and black or white opinions, because football doesn't function in black or white opinions, right? Everything is so interlinked that it's impossible to separate everything, which means in this world of you're either one thing or the other, it's yes or no, it's, you know, black or white, it's just one extreme or the other, every opinion in the world about football is wrong. Everybody's wrong. Everybody, about everything. There's not a single right opinion in the world of the NFL, right? Because everything has two or three different things that influence it to a varying degree. So when you look at pressure, you're right. You can swing it completely if your scheme is idiotic and it's not giving guys the ability to get the ball out of their hands fast enough so they're getting murdered, right? And you go back to, remember, the Minnesota Vikings when they were still rolling with North Turner's offense, and it was 7-step drops, and it was 2 receivers out in patterns and a bad offensive line, and there was nowhere to go with the football, right? And this was, is Teddy Bridgewater conservative, or did he just not have any opportunities to, you know, execute simple passes that other quarterbacks did, right? We didn't know because the scheme was such a heavily influencing factor. Tom Brady and the Patriots, when they had the worst receiving core in the NFL, it made the offensive line worse. It made Tom Brady worse under pressure because nobody is open. And no matter how long Tom Brady held the ball for, nobody would get open. So he got worse overall. The offensive line got worse because he had to hold the ball longer. He got worse under pressure because when he held the ball so long that the offensive line gave up pressure, he didn't have anywhere to go with the ball. So he had to make worse things happen under pressure. So the receiving core made two or three other things look worse. So, you know, we're trying to sort of look at this and distill it and say, well, this is the quarterback. It's this guy is inherently susceptible to pressure. But you're right. It's all dependent on like three other things at any given moment. And what you have to hope is, you know, when you're talking about Jimmy G is this type of player and Tua is this type of player, what you're really saying is like within tolerances of the other influencing factors, right? Like assuming the scheme isn't catastrophic and assuming his supporting cast isn't catastrophic, like assuming they are just in the normal range of tolerances, he's this type of player. But you can't put that out there because it's 7 layers of caveat beyond what anybody is listening, particularly, you know, on Twitter. Like, try imagine, yeah, here's what I'm actually trying to say, here are the 7 caveats that need to come after it. Nobody's reading them, right? Yeah. So everyone just puts out these opinions, and because they are wrong, because they're all contingent on these other things, that's what sparks debate. And that's why football as an entity, the NFL, is an all-conquering force, because every opinion in the world is wrong.
And that's a lot. So that's also why a lot of people hate the analytics, right? When it comes to football, I guess they hate it with all sports, but in football in particular, you could poke more holes in theories that have come through, you know, numbers driven analysis. You could poke more holes because there's more outliers, right? It's like, well, you said this, but you know, this other thing happened and this other thing happened and this other thing happened. It doesn't back up your point. Where I think in other sports, it is more clear. Like, we had this insight, and it's just a lot more stable. It's a lot more consistent. Whereas in football, if we're giving an opinion and say, hey, clean pocket's more stable than a pressured pocket, we're not nearly as confident in that year to year than, say, in baseball, that on-base percentage is better than batting average, right? Like, you could feel really confident that avoiding outs in baseball is better than, you know, batting average, and you could prove that it's more consistent. Whereas in football, we could say, hey, clean pocket's better than pressured pocket and this and that, but there'd probably be way more outliers in a given season, especially when you look at it year to year. There's just more dependencies. One of the interesting things about the list, all of our highest-rated quarterbacks from last year, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Justin Herbert, Joe Burrow, they're all in the middle of the pack, right? And they're in the middle of the pack because we're just gauging the drop-off. They all had high, clean pocket passing grades. They all had not disastrous pressured pocket grades. All those guys, Brady, Herbert, Rodgers, Burrow, all graded between, you know, 54 and 61 under pressure, right? So not great, but clearly under pressure, that's pretty decent, and they're all 90-plus as far as clean pocket goes. So I think, like, you want your quarterback to probably be in the middle of the pack here, right? You don't want them to be a disaster under pressure, and you don't want them to be a disaster in a clean pocket either, because that's the guys at the bottom of the list.
The only quarterback that's an elite quarterback that was in the bottom end of this in terms of there wasn't a big drop-off was Josh Allen.
Josh Allen, yeah.
30th out of 32 quarterbacks. So his clean pocket grade actually, I mean, it's not like it was bad, but it wasn't amazing. 81.6, which is fine, but, you know, that's marginally better than Jalen Hurts. It's, you know, it's not a phenomenal passing grade at all, but his pressured passing grade was 63.8. So that wasn't a big drop-off. He was particularly good under pressure, which, you know, generally, I mean, it doesn't mean anything necessarily, but because of what we talked about of, you know, the volatility of that number, it's at least a little bit of a red flag to say maybe that area of Josh Allen's game gets worse next year.
Oh, now, that could be entirely off. You're calling for a Josh Allen regression. You heard it here first. Sam thinks Josh Allen, send the apology form back. Mm-hmm. Sam thinks Josh Allen's going to regress next year.
Now, that could be entirely offset by him improving next year in a clean pocket, right? Because as I say, that is not a phenomenal clean pocket grade for Josh Allen. And if we see him jump forward in that area, it could completely offset any regression that happens in terms of pressure. Also, Josh Allen, as we've seen, is kind of a freak. It's entirely possible that Josh Allen is freaky enough in terms of what he's able to do to just break that, you know, as a data point and be a perennially good player under pressure, better than, you know, average guys, better than the normal quarterback is able to achieve. And that, you know, that's entirely not beyond the realms of possibility. I don't think he's had, you know, as long as Josh Allen has been good, which admittedly is a 2-year sample size, he hasn't been bad under pressure, right? His PFF grade has been at least 65.6 under pressure in either of those two seasons, right? That's abnormally high. So that could be him, right? This is a 6'5", 240-pound dude that can juke defensive backs, jump over linebackers, and power his way through defensive linemen, right? That allows you to do an awful lot under pressure that other quarterbacks simply do not have in the golf bag. On the other hand, you know, so it's battling that against, like, the inherent volatility of play under pressure.
So the way you would read this list, again, PFF.com, we're looking at article ranking the quarterbacks under pressure from 2021. Again, it's a 1-year sample size, and their biggest differences from clean pocket to pressured pocket. If you're reading this list, the players at the top of the list, you might think, hey, this bodes well for them. This actually bodes well that Garoppolo and Tua, Davis Mills, Justin Fields, Jameis Winston's five, Derek Carr six. These guys had a big drop off under pressure last year. Because of the volatility there, that could get better. Those guys could have better seasons this year. The guys at the bottom of the list, you might think, could regress. And that includes Josh Allen there. You just described why, hey, maybe he's an outlier in that case. But the other guys maybe to be concerned about, Dak Prescott, 27th overall in as far as the difference between clean pocket to pressured. He was really good under pressure last year. Is that going to regress? Jared Goff was 28th. Daniel Jones, 29th. You mentioned Allen was 30th. I think 31 and 32 are interesting, though, the last two. Carson Wentz and then Jalen Hurts. The guys, they both graded in the 70s from a clean pocket, but Wentz was not that bad under pressure. Hurts was actually pretty good under pressure, relatively. If those regress a little bit and they maintain their status from a clean pocket, it could be a rough season for a couple NFC East quarterbacks, Carson Wentz, Jalen Hurts. It's a big year for Hurts to figure out, okay, is he going to continue to progress? And then with Wentz, just a weird season overall for him, right? I mean, he's always had he's had some decent years under pressure because he's got weird we're going to say this. He's Josh Allen light, I guess, right? Like when Wentz came out, he was described the same. Big dude, cannon for an arm, athletic. So you see some of those freak plays from Wentz. But he just kind of dropped off at the end of the season, and he just wasn't efficient enough from a clean pocket. And then Hurts, I assume A.J. Brown is going to make everything get better for Jalen Hurts, but having a 63 grade in a pressured pocket, that is tough to maintain for anybody, you know, no matter what your situation is. So Wentz and Hurts are guys who, again, weren't great last year, but also have this profile that says, hey, they could actually get worse based off the way this breakdown goes.
Yeah, there's a lot of data in Carson Wentz's season, which if you talked about the box score being a particularly crappy measure of football generally. I don't know if there's a better way of pointing that out than Carson Wentz last season, right? Carson Wentz last season, there are a lot of people that are sort of saying, you know, he was fine. He was good because you look at 27 touchdowns and 7 interceptions. That's like, you know, an almost Aaron Rodgers type of touchdown to interception ratio. And touchdown to interception ratio is just sort of like, it's just advanced enough that it feels like smart analysis. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh, like we're beyond, you know, cumulative yards and just touchdown. Like we're now looking at the ratio, and the ratio is like, that's math. That's smart. That's analytics, right? So there were people that are like, oh, you know, touchdown interception rate, that's great. Therefore, Carson Wentz in Indianapolis was actually fine. And everybody that's sort of saying this guy was terrible, including, by the way, like the people that just drop kicked him out of the building that brought him over there last year, those guys lit him on fire on their way out the door and said this was catastrophic. The touchdown interception ratio lies badly about what Carson Wentz did last season. That was an offense that kind of protected him reasonably well, and there was still quite a lot of ugly play in there. And it didn't necessarily happen under pressure, which is the really concerning thing. So, you know, Wentz has been all over the place under pressure throughout his career. He's had insanely good seasons under pressure, and that's where you got that, like, MVP caliber year from, which is why at the time, you know, we were saying, This is pretty unsustainable here. I'm not sure you're going to see this guy again. And then you've also gotten reasonable seasons under pressure. But the fact that means that the sort of the bad that everybody saw from Carson Wentz last season, if you watch the games, generally wasn't happening under pressure. It wasn't a product of the pressure that was coming. It was just bad. That, I think, is worrying for projecting him forward, you know, to a new team and a new environment, et cetera.
Yeah, man, I'm not going to push back on you for that. You know, I'm supposed to push back on you more, but sometimes we agree. A lot of times we agree. So, yeah, Wentz 31, Hurts 32 on the list. Go check it out. Ranking the quarterbacks under pressure in 2021 and their drop-offs.
You understand that Greg Rosenthal is just sitting there shaking his head in disappointment at you.
There's no way he's this deep into it. There's no way he listens to all of our content, right?
I don't know. Maybe the man's, you know, maybe he's got some time for podcasts. Maybe he's, you know, on the bike right, on the Peloton instead of the music or the motivational dude on the TV or whatever the hell Peloton works.
Listens to us.
He's listening to us.
I think that we should be a Peloton station. How's that work?
I don't know. That's that motivate. You know that there's that motivation.
Motivational trainer, PFF NFL podcast.
Yeah.
Let us know. Should we do that? Anything else you want to hit on today? This Baker question, and then we're out.
Yeah, let's do that because Twitter's mad at me.
Oh, why?
So I was on Ari Mayrov's podcast.
Yeah.
My Sports Update. That's his Twitter handle. You know, one of PFF's kind of NFL insider guys. And, you know, we talked about a bunch of things. And one of the things we were talking about is how the funny thing is for – so the rumors swirling about Baker to the Seahawks now. There's been rumors about Baker to Carolina, you know, before. We know that Baker is presumably going to get traded at some point, blah, blah. This is the sort of the background, all this. And we were talking about how the funny thing is, from Baker's point of view, his only good – quote unquote, like environment to be in for this year is Cleveland, right? Like when you look at supporting cast, Seattle is one of the worst rosters in the NFL. Like without Russell Wilson, that team is a dumpster fire now. And putting Baker Mayfield on it doesn't do Baker Mayfield a lot of good in terms, because remember, like he had the contract pulled out from under him, right? The rug pulled out from under his feet. That's why he's pissed off with the Browns. They went after Deshaun Watson. All of a sudden, because he played hurt all year, Baker's gone from like, hey, is my $40 million a year deal just over the horizon to like, I have one shot now at securing like another starting gig somewhere. So I don't think you want to do that in Seattle this year because that team is terrible. I don't know that you want to do it in Carolina because the environment doesn't look – you've got good receivers in both teams, to be fair. Carolina – you know, went to work a little bit on the offensive line. I still don't think that line is good. I don't know that the offense generally is a great situation. The team looks like it's heading on its way to toward everybody getting fired. So I don't know that that's a great environment either. And that's pretty much the only two teams that need a quarterback, right? So if you're Baker Mayfield and you're saying, right, I need one good year to convince the league that I don't suck, because apparently that's where they think I am. The only place that's possible is Cleveland. I just don't think that's happening in either of the other two teams. So he's now in this tough spot where Deshaun Watson might get suspended for the whole year, right? And all of a sudden the Browns are now in this situation where the guy they traded everything for is on the shelf. They have a Super Bowl contending caliber roster, and the options at quarterback are Jacoby Brissett for an entire year, or somehow we mend the burned bridge with Baker Mayfield and he starts for a year. And I essentially tweeted this out and Browns fans are big mad. They're like, do you understand? It's dead. It's done. They burned the bridge. They don't want any part of Baker. He's never playing for the Browns again. He's out of here. They're trying to get rid of his salary. They're willing to eat it so that he goes somewhere else. All of these things are true. But if the Browns have some sense, they should take a beat, analyze the situation and realize that in this, if Deshaun Watson does get suspended for an entire year, Cleveland and Baker Mayfield's goals are actually in perfect alignment, even if they hate each other, right? That it's actually the best thing for both teams, or for both parties, rather, if Baker Mayfield is the starting quarterback, because he's by far their best option.
Compelling case, Sam. But you're also the guy that's Mr. Touchy-feely QB room guy, right? You're the same guy that's like, oh, you can't draft two quarterbacks. They're going to get upset. They're going to be sad.
Yep.
We do literally have a broken bridge, a burnt bridge in Cleveland. This would be like, see if I can get an extra metaphor here. We're trying to take the PFF NFL podcast to the next level. We fire Sam. We hire Greg Rosenthal. Greg's going to take us to the promised land. And then he gets in here. And gets arrested. Greg's crazy. He's just doing some shady stuff behind the scenes. And we don't know. Gets arrested. He's out. And we come crawling back to you. Hey, the Greg experiment didn't work out. We need Sam. Right? And we come back to you. We haven't traded you yet. You're still in the building, but you've been kicked off the podcast. You coming back? You coming, hey, this is best for my career. I got to go back to the PFF NFL podcast. What am I going to do? Start a podcast with Renner? That's not going to go anywhere. You're going to come back to me? There's a burnt bridge there, Sam. Mm. And I mean, this is just a bad example, but that's a really burnt bridge in Cleveland.
It is.
By the way, I don't have any inside information that Greg is a potential felon or anything like that. I'm just
okay. Just important caveat. Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing is, so it is. It's generally speaking, I'm against upsetting the apple cart and pissing off a starting quarterback. The thing is, they've already done it, right? Like, they already burned the bridge. They went after Deshaun Watson. They secured Deshaun Watson, and consequently, Baker Mayfield is pissed off. He doesn't want to play for you anymore. That's why you don't do that, right? That's why generally you don't upset the incumbent quarterback, because he gets the hump and he wants out. But that's already the case. So it's not like you can piss him off further. All you need to do is to persuade both sides that look at the options, right? Look at your alternatives, right? I already outlined the Baker Mayfield alternatives. You don't want to play for Cleveland, fine. Your alternatives are you go to Carolina, that team probably sucks, you don't get another starting gig. You go to Seattle, that team really sucks, you don't get another starting gig. Your only shot at the second contract that you want, the big, you know, life-changing, set for generations type of wealth that you were on the cusp of a year ago, your only chance at that money is a season in Cleveland where you play well and convince everybody else that, you know, your bad year was the shoulder, right? From Cleveland's point of view, they don't have Deshaun Watson. They have a Super Bowl contending roster. Your two alternatives are Jacoby Brissett or like some random from the street, right? Or you convince Baker Mayfield that he plays for you again.
Or Josh Dobbs.
Yes. Which some random off the street, I think, covers Josh Dobbs. So if you're all, or your final alternative is we just literally set fire to this season, right? You've assembled a championship caliber roster and we are going to torch 1 year of that window. We're simply going to burn it rather than bring Baker Mayfield into the building because of the risk of what that could do to a locker room or to the environment or whatever. I would simply argue that there's no conceivable scenario where their alternatives are better than the year of Baker Mayfield playing pissed off to try and earn himself a deal.
First off, I would love to see this. Okay.
Yeah, of course.
I would love to see this happen.
And listen, hang on. One final point.
Do you think go ahead.
I'm not trying to say this would be pleasant for everybody involved, right? This would be a miserable, antagonistic, toxic, tense environment for all year where it is clear that everybody hates each other.
Stay together for the kids, Baker and Cleveland.
But look at the sporting world. That has worked before, right? Kobe and Shaq hated each other for most of their careers. Michael Jordan and that dude from the front office couldn't stand each other,
Jerry Krause.
They were winning championships, right? This is something that has happened. Think of the number of times where teams and players have gone head-to-head over a contract. You know, they've stared each other down. Like, the holdout didn't work. The dude got his ass back in the building and just worked, right? And played well and had a good year. That's what we're talking about here. It would be unpleasant for everybody involved, but it would be 1 year, and it's the only way this team isn't bad this year.
Okay. 2 points on this, though, first of all, because I would love to see it happen. I think it'd be awesome. I think first point, competitors don't view situations the way we do as analysts. I don't think players, sometimes they do. Like, you'd rather be in a good – you want to be in a good situation, but we don't always – it's not always defined the way we do it. We define good situations by, like, looking at their offensive line and look at their receivers and this is good and whatever. They're looking at their coaches, you know, the environment to develop. But as competitors, they're also saying, I'm good. I'm going to elevate the Seahawks. I'm going to elevate the Panthers, right? So the competitive situation. The second point – all of these decisions that the Browns made, they knew in the back of their mind Deshaun Watson could be suspended. Now, more recently, it's come out that it seems that the NFL is going to push for a year-long suspension. We'll see where it lands. Maybe at the time, they anticipated 8 games or whatever, 10 games or whatever, and they're like, hey, we can handle that, and we'll bring in Jacoby Brissett. He's the best, one of the better backups in the league. He's got starting experience. Let's do that. But also in the real back of their mind, they had to know there was a worst-case scenario here, and they still went forward with the decision to not only pursue Deshaun Watson, but to bring in Jacoby Brissett, to essentially let, you know, make it known that Baker Mayfield's not going to be a Brown any longer and put him out in the trading block and all that stuff. Now, I don't know if there was a really, I don't know if there was a world where they could hedge and say, you know, they were, but they entered this world willingly. You know what I mean?
Sure.
All that said, I would love to see it. I mean, I do. I agree with the premise that if Baker wants to have 1 year to hit the market and prove what he can do, I agree. Cleveland would be the best situation versus Seattle or Carolina, or there's nowhere else, right? The Giants. I mean, there's nowhere else where he could go. Knows the system. Like, we're already at this point where, like, learning a new system and interacting with new receivers and all that stuff is tough. So I agree with that premise. I just don't know if it's just too late and this is a pipe dream. But I would be entertained by this.
So here's the thing. I think it probably is too late in a pipe dream. I don't think the Cleveland Browns are interested. I don't think Baker Mayfield is interested. I don't think either party is interested in this scenario, right? The problem is, I think they should be. I think both sides need to realize that this is the reality they're facing, which is, if Watson isn't there, the only way there's success for either side is if they're together, even no matter how much they hate each other. The two things I would say, one, you brought up, so you're right. Baker Mayfield probably doesn't think the same way I think in terms of that guy's only chance of success is being in Cleveland. But that's the responsibility of his agent, right? And dude, if anybody's agent owes him one, it's Baker Mayfield's agent, because he didn't shut him down last year, right? Somebody, Baker Mayfield was, you know, there's that phrase, a duty of care, right? Whoever was sort of surrounding Baker Mayfield last year all failed him in terms of duty of care. You know, that guy went out there, played all season with a busted shoulder that only got worse as the year wore on, and nobody shut him down, right? The team should have shut him down at some point. His advisors certainly should have shut him down. Now, I don't know if Baker Mayfield just overruled them all and was like, no, I'm playing, screw you guys. And every step of the way, everybody else was trying to get him to shut down. But for him to have been allowed, essentially, to, like, Baker Mayfield destroyed his career last year. And people allowed him to do that. So Baker Mayfield's agent, I would suggest, owes him a solid, right? And if that solid is sitting him down and trying to give him some home truths of like, dude, I love you, but we haven't seen enough from you to suggest that you can make Seattle into a contending team, you know, and earn yourself a second deal. Certainly, when compared with the team you have around you in Cleveland right now, you need to swallow your pride. You need to get on with it, and you just need to stay in Cleveland, right? That somebody needs to sit Baker Mayfield down and explain that to him. And to me, that's the job of his agent. Secondly, I would make the argument that, look, Carson Wentz, right? Carson Wentz gets mad, gets butthurt. The dude starts playing like an absolute shell of himself, and Carson Wentz is broken. Carson Wentz, I would suggest, does not play well when Carson Wentz is mad, right? Yeah. I would suggest that Baker Mayfield falls into the category of Sidney Dean from White Men Can't Jump, right?
Yep.
And remember when Woody Harrelson is winding him up, he's like, what are you doing? He goes, I'm doing two things. I'm making them mad. Because most people don't play well when they're mad. And then he goes, so you're pissing me off. He goes, yeah, that's the other thing I'm doing. Because I think you play better when you're mad. I don't think you're like those other people. I think Baker Mayfield plays better when he's mad. I think a pissed off Baker Mayfield is like a pissed off Aaron Rodgers. And those guys play well when they're annoyed, right? We've seen that throughout his college career. All right, not so much in the NFL, but in college, you know, when he would find ways to be annoyed, right? The planting the flag thing, the beaning a dude warming up in his end zone, all these things. Baker Mayfield found ways of being irritated, and Baker Mayfield played well when he was irritated. I would suggest that Baker Mayfield playing with like a permanent chip on his shoulder all season because he hates the team would actually result in a pretty good Baker Mayfield. So
I agree with that point too, that you would have a better, he's one of those quarterbacks that could work for. I think what you just mentioned about the agent thing and Baker and stuff, I mean, that could be the Browns' pitch here if they do want this, right? And say, look, we know you put it on the line last year for us. We know you went out there and played hurt. We know you went out there and played hurt, and it affected your performance. And that's perhaps soured our relationship. However, here are your options, Baker. We could trade you to Seattle. By the way, have you seen that they have two rookie tackles? Have you seen that? You know? Now, if the offensive line's decent in Seattle, throwing to DK and Tyler Lockett, it's not bad. Seattle might not have a great roster, but it's not a terrible situation if they could sort out the O-line. But yeah, anyway.
If the offensive line has been crippling for a decade, isn't crippling this year.
I'm just saying, it's not completely unattractive to throw to DK and Lockett. But option one, we could send you to Seattle. Option two, we could send you to Carolina. Have you seen their situation over there? Again, you could talk yourself into Carolina not being that bad. O-line's better. You have DJ Moore. You got Robbie Anderson there, even though he's had issues. I mean, you have Christian McCaffrey. You could convince yourself that Carolina or Seattle's not as disastrous as we may put it in, like, roster rankings and all that stuff. But Cleveland's pitch could be simple here. Look, you know Watson's out. You know Watson's going to be our guy next year. This is your best opportunity. I mean, the Browns could sell it to Baker and his agent the same way you're selling it. We're going to give you an opportunity to shine. We appreciate what you've done for the organization. I was talking to a Browns fan this weekend who's like, Baker's my guy forever. You know why? He beat the Steelers in the playoffs. You know, like, Browns fans, there are some Browns fans who view it through that lens. Like, we never made the playoffs. Baker was a hero for a little bit. He beat the Steelers in the playoffs. You know, like, I'm with this guy forever. Just pitch that to him. Pitch that back to him.
I also think, by the way, that, like, the trade should not be a determining factor here, because Baker Mayfield's trade value right now is awful. Like, we are talking about the only way they can even make a trade happen is if Cleveland eats half of his contract this year. You know, so what are you – you're going to get, what, a mid to low round pick maximum, right?
Yeah.
Versus – if he plays well this year and signs somewhere next year for a decent deal, you're going to get a compensatory draft pick, right? And all the difference, which might end up being the same as the pick you were going to get this year in terms of any kind of trade you can make happen with Carolina or Seattle. And the only difference is you paid him a full year of his salary instead of half a season of his salary for presumably much better play than you would get out of Jacoby Brissett. So for Cleveland, I think the trade aspect versus, like, letting him walk next year is essentially a wash. What you are actually evaluating is the nightmare of a Baker Mayfield-led team this year versus, like, how much better he is than Jacoby Brissett and what we can achieve this year. And by the way, like, the Baker Mayfield hate has gone, like, completely around the bend. Because I'm getting a bunch of people tweeting me saying there's no difference between Baker Mayfield and Jacoby Brissett. Now, look, Jacoby Brissett is a fun, hilarious player to watch play football. But if you're of the opinion that there's no difference between Baker and Jacoby Brissett, you're out of your freaking mind, because that's insane.
Now, somebody might push back and say, well, last year Jacoby Brissett graded better than Baker Mayfield. And right. I would just say, when
with
we make
two healthy shoulders.
With these evaluations, you have to figure out the other factors here. Brissett had a smaller sample size. He has two full starting seasons where he graded under 60 both years, 2017, 2019 with the Colts. So when we've seen Jacoby Brissett as a starter, he's always been worse than Baker Mayfield's 4 years as a starter. So yes, Baker Mayfield, overall, better player than Jacoby Brissett.
I would say a significantly better player. Anyway, so the upshot of all this is, I agree with everybody saying it won't happen, right? I don't think either side wants this. In fact, I think both sides very much don't want it. But I would argue that both of those sides need to sit back and analyze the alternatives and say that we need to make this happen. In Cleveland's situation in particular, I don't remember, when was the last time you can think of a championship or a team that thought of themselves as contenders voluntarily burning a season, right? Saying this is not a, we're willingly not contending this year with a championship caliber contending team. Teams essentially sacrifice a season regularly, but they're usually the ones that suck.
I don't think they would view it that way.
Come on. They're not convincing themselves they're still contenders with Jacoby Brissett.
They would look at Jacoby Brissett and say, first off, last year he did play pretty well overall. Fine. Secondly, they would say, because we've built such a good system around him, he'll be good enough. And then thirdly, they'll say, well, we don't have the distraction of Baker, right? We don't have the drama. We don't have all of that other stuff. They can convince themselves that Jacoby Brissett is a better option than Baker Mayfield at this time with the other things circling around Baker with the burnt bridge.
Andrew Berry is a smart man. The Browns are an analytic organization. They just watched the entire AFC engage in a Cold War-esque arms race to the moon. There is not a hope in hell that that side, that that collection of people believes that this team is still even relevant in a Super Bowl conversation with Jacoby Brissett.
But they're compared in the discussion. But the discussion is Jacoby Brissett or Baker Mayfield.
Yeah.
In that discussion, they can make the case that Jacoby Brissett is a better option given everything that's happened with Baker. That's my point.
I think that the question is there any chance whatsoever of winning a Super Bowl with either of these quarterbacks? The answer with Jacoby Brissett is absolutely no. Like, just no. Period. Exclamation point. Whatever punctuation you want to put on it, no. The answer with Baker Mayfield is not as clear. It's probably not, but there's at least, it's not equivocal the way it is with Brissett.
Let us know. What do you think? Should Baker Mayfield go to the Browns? Light up Sam at PFF underscore Sam. Especially if you disagree. Well, we've got it was a fun show. Good discussion. Want to hear everybody chime in. Leave us comments if you want to react to everything we've discussed here. Also, don't forget, tell a friend about the PFF NFL podcast, especially here in the offseason. But most importantly, leading into next season, be with us every single week. Because that's what we do, break down games. We threw an extra show in there for you guys last year, planning on doing a lot of the same for next year. So thanks to Manscaped. Thanks to Underdog Fantasy for being a part of the show. Don't forget, 25% off using the promo code NFLPOD. And get in touch with us via email, nflpodcast@pff.com. Follow us on TikTok, on Twitter, the whole deal. PFF NFL Podcast on TikTok, at PFF NFL Pod on Twitter. We'll be back on Thursday with some more great NFL action. Thanks for tuning in.